Hi, this is Wings Hauser, and you're in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
My dear lawyers make movies. I make films. Films based on reality.
It's a real good movie script.
Yeah. If the director doesn't fuck it up, we could do some real numbers at the box office.
What about me? You gonna put me in your film, huh?
All right, we got ourselves a game, man. Let's play. You and me, let's play this fucking thing.
I mean, while you're out there at your banquets and your fundraisers, he's in the streets with the kid.
And what brought you here?
Movies.
Movies? Do you want to be an actress, or do you want to be a star?
Both.
Why don't we make you a star?
I think this guy is filming people as he kills them.
I know how much she meant to you.
Well, she didn't mean a damn thing to me.
Now, little piggy. Take your gun out.
He was with Summer. She's dead. He was with Janet. She's dead.
Yeah, but the downward stab of the knife indicates the guy was at least 6'3".
I don't want to see, hear, or know you exist in this city until this case is closed. You got that?
We live in a violent world. We sit in front of our TV sets waiting to catch a glimpse of a dead body on the freeway. Directors dream of shooting such reality, but do they?
Beyond Pacino.
Killed the wrong man.
What the hell are you talking about?
You're suspended. Without pay.
Jack! There's somebody here to see you.
Do you like it?
It's still rough. There's no music yet. No special effects. And I need two more scenes.
Do it! Yeah! Pull it! Oh, that's it!
Oh, come on!
Yes,
no, please!
Shut up! Shut up! Do it! Do it! Do it!
And that, my friend, is the magic of film.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Hello.
This week, we're covering the 1991 Wings Hauser written and directed film, The Art of Dying.
And this is yet another first for The Projection Booth, I'd say.
Score one for The Projection Booth. I will agree with you wholeheartedly. And I think that Wings Hauser movies do not get, as far as I know, any kind of coverage on any sort of podcast.
Agreed. You know, that really sort of blows my mind, actually, because this film in particular is a real gem in the rough. And, you know, it seems a little ahead of its time and to a degree.
So how do you see that?
Well, the concept, for starters, you know, even though the story is no way similar, you know, The Art of Dying has this great vibe to it. And, you know, it kind of reminds me in a way of Michael Pollan's Peeping Tom. And then also the vibe of the atmosphere or whatever, you know, it seems like it pops up again, you know, the following year or whatever when David Fincher made Seven.
Right. And Fincher Seven has led us to a whole shitload of movies, including some of those horrible Saw films and, you know, the Hostel films and all those things. I could definitely see some of Saw and Hostel inside of The Art of Dying.
You think the Saw films are horrible?
I do not enjoy the Saw films, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I gotta say, you know, they didn't really start getting good till number three. Three, four, five, six, and seven have been great.
Well, I kind of quit after number one, so.
Now, Mike, you were an Art of Dying virgin prior to this week's show. I wanted to see, you know, if you'd like to summarize the film.
All right, so yeah, I'm going to try my best. I've watched this a couple times, and I enjoy it, though sometimes I'm like, what the hell is going on? it's a darn good movie, and I enjoy it all the way through, but it's like there are a couple times where I just kind of, I don't know, like maybe I stopped paying attention or something. But so anyway, Wings Hauser plays Jack. He's a cop, and there's a killer, and the killer is going through, and he's making movies, making snuff films, basically, that are based on primarily other films, and he is pretty much showing that he is the best film director of all times and murderer. And so he goes through and kills a whole bunch of people, and Wings Hauser goes after him, and Sarah Douglas is there playing a woman named Sarah, And she's just kind of hanging out at the police station with a British accent. And it's like, oh, okay. And I really miss her whole Ursa haircut, man, because she was looking so fine in Superman 2. And in this movie, not so good. But at least Wings is there, and at least Michael J. Pollard is there. And Michael J. Pollard is just freaking amazing. Anytime that guy is on screen, I am there. I'm right there.
Right. Sarah Douglas, I think, is – it's funny you mentioned Superman 2 because – I think she's more attractive in Conan the Destroyer.
Well, I can see that, but I don't know. I like that kind of butch look that she's got going on in Superman 2.
You know, she's even hotter, and I think about it, in Return of Swamp Thing, and even more hotter in Meatballs 4, which nice. Someday we'll cover because I love Meatballs 4 like it's no one's business. We're going to get Corey Feldman, Sari Douglas, and Jack Nance in one movie.
That is so awesome. I remember when you talked to Corey Feldman, we were at Horror Hound, and he was just like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's one of my favorite roles ever. And do you have any blow on you?
I think Corey Haim used it all.
Oh, nice.
All right. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Art of Dying. You know, I discovered it a few years back, so I'm a huge Wings Hauser fan, and I really appreciate the film for what it is. You know, I mentioned it's a little bit ahead of its time, and I guess I think that because of the subject matter, like I mentioned earlier, and plus, it's got really great cinematography in it, and it's really interesting. You know, there's not any movies out there that you can think of where, you know, the serial killer is a gay filmmaker that likes to duplicate famous Hollywood movies and death scenes.
Yeah. And then, like, I love his, like, little lackey guy, Latin Jerry. Latin Jerry is, like, one of the best characters ever.
You remind me of Latin Jerry on so many levels.
Really?
Latin Jerry is so over the top because he's, like, wowed by everything. So he's like, genius! Christmas! Presents!
Christmas! Hollywood!
And do I do that quite often?
Yeah, you do it all the time, actually. You usually do it when you're on the telephone, because you're on the telephone constantly.
Oh, yeah, well, there is that.
Right, so, yeah, you know, in your synopsis, you know, I know we're not trying to give it away, but, you know, the killer recreates he recreates famous scenes from films as snuff films. So there's a brilliant take on The Deer Hunter, Psycho, Scarface. And then, you know, it could be disputed in terms of he's actually making a tribute to Joan of Arc, because there is the final sequence of the film where the character is trying to kill Wings Hauser's love interest, played by Kathleen Kinmont, at the stake, a la Joan of Arc.
And I love the beginning of this movie, too. The beginning reminds me a little bit of Vertigo, actually, with the, you know, the Wings Hauser and his partner coming in and just them exchanging their, you know, like ribbing and stuff. Obviously that's not Vertigo, but what is like Vertigo to me is a little bit like how there's the accident, quote unquote, at the beginning that kind of fucks up Wings Hauser for the rest of the film. And he's just kind of trying to get over that. It's kind of like Scotty when he's hanging off of the building at the beginning of Vertigo and, you know, always trying to get over that throughout the rest of the film.
Well, maybe we could say that Art of Dying is the Vertigo from PM Entertainment.
It could be. You know, and Wings Hauser is, frankly, he's being the auteur that Hitchcock was in all those films.
Right. You know, so a few weeks back, Mike and I got to talk to Wings Hauser in a very rare interview. You know, Wings doesn't give a lot of interviews. In fact, at the end of 2010, he granted me some time with him for Mondo Video, and at the time, it was his first interview he had given in over a decade. The interview turned out really great, that someone actually at a Hollywood studio saw it, and now he's working on a project with them. So another home run, a first for podcasts, and of course, we, the bad mofos of the projection booth, offer it up to you, the listeners, a first.
A first!
So, starting off, tell us how you got involved in the project.
Well, you know, this PM Entertainment, you've heard of them, right?
Yes.
They came to me, I guess, about a year before this and offered me, they said, we'll let you direct, but you have to star or be in the film. And it was, I thought that was, you know, something you couldn't turn down. Plus, they were paying very little money, you know, so. But it was a great place to be a first-time director and get your, you know, feet wet at that. So I directed a film called Cold Fire, which was just, you know, there was really nobody in it. I mean, we couldn't afford anything. It was like, know, we made the film for like, I think, 95 cents. But this one kid was walking down the hall in PM Entertainment. He's going to read for a really tiny part. And he had the best voice going. It sounded like Alec Baldwin. And I went, you know, I cast the guy, and he's gone on to do some sweet stuff. His name's Michael Easton. I don't know if you heard of him. But so anyhow, I did a couple of films with them, and then, you know, this was just in the progression. And I think this was the third film I did with them. So it was just part of a deal there.
And you also came up with the idea for the script, right?
I think Joseph and I came up with, you know, we bantered it back and forth. But, you know, I mean, that's my dialogue. That's you know, obviously, I mean, look, Joseph Murray gave me the break of a lifetime. But, you know, I mean, the guy's from Syria. He certainly isn't writing dialogue like that, you know. So, but I'm sure he would, you know, he'd say the same thing. You know, but he gave me a break, and I just loved it. So I never made a stink about it, you know. But, yeah, that was pretty much, you know. And then there was not a lot of improv, but there was a lot of, you know, working with the actors, going, how do you feel about this? You know, let's try this. And, you know, just jumping around because we had all this freedom. Nobody was breathing down our neck, you know. I mean, even, you know, normally, even a movie of the week, you know, they're just kicking your ass. So this was really, it was just, you know, a lot of fun, you know, and really learning about the camera, learning about angles, all the crap that you never paid attention to.
Right. And one thing that's truly interesting about it, too, and I know you and I have talked about this before, is some of that ad lib or, you know, some of that dialogue, which in particular I'm reminded of that scene where, you know, you're driving that girl home and you talk about seeing Ray Rogers going down the road on his horse. So I wondered if you could talk about, you know, how you grew up in California and, you know, didn't you have some famous neighbors?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I was... First of all, I was born in Hollywood, of all places. My father was a writer in Hollywood, you know, and started off in radio, wrote The Whistler. You know, people out there would remember that from the radio days. But, anyhow, so, you know, I mean, and the stories of Roy Rogers, you know, riding down Hollywood Boulevard, all these stories were rampant. You know, anything to get publicity in those days. So what's really amazing is that I grew up in this little place called Lake Sherwood, which is about 30 miles north of L.A. And we had to move out there because I had asthma. And, you know, anyhow, my father was a fisherman. He loved to fish. So it's just this little lake in the mountains there. What was amazing is that Roy Rogers, Alan Ladd, and Eve Arden all had little mini kind of ranches next to the lake, right? Those were the rich people out there. And then there was, you know, just the, you know, the workers, you know, like my father and, you know, the rest of the people. My next door neighbor was Bob Denver, if you can believe that. He was, you know, a little buddy on Gilligan's Island. And these are great stories growing up there. You know, Bob was, he was like, you know, the first hippie in Maynard G. Krebs on Dobie Gillis. And when I met him, he was absolutely a hippie. But he had, and this is the honest and honest truth, he had two wild cheetahs living at his house. These are like huge, full-grown lion cheetahs and a huge chimp. And in the backyard that was like nestled up to our yard was this huge cheetah run where the cheetahs would go out there and just run. But in the meantime, when they weren't in the cage there, they'd be in the house just laying around. And you go down there, and, you know, this is the 60s. There's a lot of marijuana going on, you know. And it's like you'd walk into this living room, there'd be these two cheetahs just, you know, frightening, right? And everybody would be just like kicked back smoking, you know, their doobies and everything. It's just amazing. But the funny thing about it, there was this chimp. And I grew up with two sisters. And they were at that time in their life where they, you know, what happens every month to a woman, right? And the cheetah would pick up on that. And we had one lock in the entire house because this community was just free-flowing. I mean, you know, nobody was worried about, you know, this was the 60s. Nobody was worried about anybody breaking in or anything like that. So we had one lock, and it was on the bathroom. And this cheetah would start screaming during one of my sister's cycles, and it was just, I mean, it was, you know, you just really thought the thing was going to rape, all-out rape my sisters, and they would go in and tremble during the day when my father was gone at work. You know, they'd be trembling in the bathroom with the only lock on the door, and I swear to God, this cheater, if he got out, you know, bathroom door would not have been a problem. He wanted my sisters, and this went on for, like, you know, I don't know, until Denver moved. But what a time. I mean, right down the street from there was this guy, Paul Watkins, who came from the really good family. We were like the bad family, you know. It's like we were loud and crazy, you know. My brothers, you know, we were just like, you know, normal kids. But right down the street was this family called the Watkins, who were just, you know, they were just the perfect family, very religious, very, you know, straight and narrow. And their son went on to become the president of Thousand Oaks High School. And the next summer, he had joined the Manson family and was the right-hand man of Charles Manson, who was procuring women for Manson. His name was Paul Watkins, who died later. But that was kind of the group of people we were looking at, you know, from Bob Denver, who was the last guy you'd ever think would be smoking marijuana is Bob Denver, right? And then you know, this straight-laced family, you know, hooking up with, you know, one of the worst characters in our history. So that was kind of the lake where I grew up.
Well, you know, Gilligan was kind of daffy. You know, he might have been, you know, rocking the Chiba.
It was amazing. The people he had over there. God, I don't think I could repeat on podcasting or anyplace else, really. But, I mean, there was some stuff going on there that was just like, sexually, it was just bizarre. I mean, I was like this kid, you know, with a guitar trying to, you know, put my first album together. And, you know, I mean, and you were so attracted to them, especially with the naked women just walking around naked. I mean, it was just wonderful, you know, to a growing boy. This was like, you know, thank you, Bob Denver. Oh, God.
Nice. You know, you mentioned music, and, you know, in The Art of Dying, in the background, you hear one of your great songs called The Old West, actually. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how that song came to light.
Well, gosh, I started writing it one day in the hills of Santa Barbara, where I had this place up there, and I made a deal with RCA over about three songs. In New York, we played three songs, and they signed us, and then we had this, like, actually come up with a whole album. So that was one of them. So it just kind of came off the top of my head. I thought it was like, you know, the hypocrisy of, like, you know, if you listen to it, it's just filled with hypocrisies. You know, go get them, John Wayne, you know. And I mean, it's just, you know, something I felt like writing at the time. And I put it in that film because in the Santa Susana Mountains, that's where, that's about where the country western is, music in Los Angeles. That's, you know, that's right up in the foothills there, where there's a, you know, little country western bars and things like that. So I think it fit well into the film.
The old west, it died last week. Those that did not know, they buried Billy Chester the thief about an hour ago. And yonder stands the yellow-haired man, screaming at the top of her lung. I know they done wrong, but the Paul's the one who taught them how to use the gun. I know they done wrong, but the Paul's the one who taught them how to use the gun. Over and over again, it's the same old story. The people, they're bruising people for love, fame, God, and glory. Mr. Lincoln died, a shot that came out of the blind. And all through the night, the Capitol shook for the man who created the crime. And Just about daybreak at old Turner's shed, Johnny Booth got shot in the head. But it really wasn't his fault, 'cause his daddy always said, the criminals in the White House, get him dead, John. It really wasn't his fault, his daddy always said, the criminals in the White House, get him dead, boy.
Right, yeah, it's a really great song, and it's one of my favorite songs off your album.
Thanks.
Yeah, and it's got a real interesting Americana sentimentality to it, and,
right.
And just so you know, anyone knows that's listening, you can listen to it on YouTube. So
excellent.
Yeah. So, and then I guess you know, getting back to the film, how did you being a first time director, or actually a second time director, how did you come to cast the film?
Well, you know, they put out a casting call. You look at pictures, and then you call people in, you know, based on those pictures. You know, it was not like, it wasn't like a studio film where, you know, I mean, the executive producers are breathing down your neck saying, this person, you know, you got to go with this. You know, I'm banging her, so you got to take her kind of thing. I'll tell you a wonderful thing with Kathleen Kinmont, the girl in there. You remember her, right?
But of course.
Okay.
How could you forget that sex scene?
Oh, my God. Well, I'll tell you, this is beautiful. I don't think she would, you know, feel bad that I'm telling this story because she's a wonderful lady. Anyhow, she comes in and we're meeting, and she had this little mark on her breast that she was talking about because the role required, you know, some topless, you know, and like a love scene, right? And it was like, well, you know, I didn't, you know, makeup can cover it up. And she goes, well, no, I think I should show it to you because I don't want to, you know, like withhold that or anything. And I'm like, oh, nah, that's okay, you know. And she's like, oh, well, I really, and she insisted. And so right in the office, man, she just opens up her blouse and shows me her breast. But it was like so clinical, you know. It was like, now here's the scar right here. Look at this, okay? Can we work around that? And I was like, yeah, no kidding. it was a wonderful moment.
Well, I'm sorry, you have a scar?
Where's the scar? I tell you, I mean, she was just wonderful to work with. But she brought her mother to the set. Now, I didn't know who her mother was. And she said, would it be okay if I brought my mother to the set? I went, yeah, no problem, you know. So she shows up, and, you know, anybody my age who saw this woman, who was her mother, would know exactly what I'm talking about. Her name was Abby Dalton. She was an actress who played on a show way back when called Hennessy. And she was every boy's dream. I mean, this woman, you know, was like the subject of many, many a lonely night by men throughout the, you know, young men throughout the United States. And there she was. And I thought, you know, Kathleen's a wonderful lady. But when I saw this woman, I couldn't talk. It was just like, oh, my God. And she looked fantastic. She probably was like, I don't know, 50, 60 years old. You know, and she looked fantastic. It was just knocked my socks off. But every time she looked at me, I felt like that, you know, that 14-year-old kid under the covers, you know.
Nice.
It was a tough day.
So I guess, you know, elaborating more on the sex scene, was this sex scene something that was in the script, the one with the milk?
No, we, you know, I mean, we could, I think, you know, I was like, okay, now you make love. They make love, you know. But the sink came into play, right? And then, you know, and it was like, I think we had some kind of idea that it would be fun to play with food. And that was what was available, the milk, you know. And, you know, we just started playing with it, you know, just pouring it on each other. It was great. It was a terrific day. That was a great day. Her mother wasn't there either that day.
So how did you I mean, you know, you have a couple really interesting you know, great actors that appear in this film as well. You have Michael J. Pollard and also Sarah Douglas. So yeah. I mean, were you a fan of Michael J. Pollard, you know,
oh,
when
God,
you were casting
yeah.
the film?
Yeah, and Michael Jay, you know, is just he's a human being all to himself. I mean, just an amazing guy. You know, he would even insist upon being picked up at the place where he lived, but nobody else could pick him up but me. He only wanted the director to pick him up, so it'd be like, you know, going like, you know, there's a lot of talking to him, you know, just you know, because he had thoughts of his own. I mean, he was like a very calm Gary Busey, you know. He was, yeah. I mean, you know, I know Gary quite well, you know, but you know, Gary marches to a different orchestra, you know, and so does Michael J. Pollard, which is just fantastic to work with, you know, because when Michael Pollard stops talking and just thinks, it's one of the most interesting things. You just on film, when you watch him thinking and trying to put a thought together, it's an amazing thing because he's really working, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah, he's
and Sarah Douglas. Let's see, did I do? How did I meet Sarah? I think I did the Beastmaster, and that's where I met Sarah Douglas.
Oh yeah, Beastmaster 2, Portal Through Time, right?
Right. Yes. Out in the desert with her, swallowing the hair from our wigs, and I've worked with her there, and then you know, and by the way, the actors we got was, you know, basically, you know, working for nothing and just doing a favor, you know, because that's the thing, when they allow you to direct, they go, yeah, you can direct, but you know, we're not going to pay anybody anything, you know, use all your contacts and everything, you know, and I called a bunch of people who didn't want to do it, you know, but you know, these people showed up, and it's just great.
Nice. So, on a serious note, actually, on a very serious note, you know, the character you're playing in that film is named Jack, and who do you think that character is? I mean, what is he a conflicted soul in any sense?
Oh, I think you know, obviously, it's got a lot to do with me, you know, and growing up in Hollywood and watching people come out here, especially with that little girl, you know. It's like watching people come out here with that dream and just being, you know, shattered. And I think he wanted to get to that little girl before she was completely shattered. You know, and that's why he drove her to the bus station. And I, you know, and the thing is, anybody who comes out here, you don't want to take their dream away. You know, but they should have the reality that, you know, this is a tough cookie and you better love what you're doing, you know, because if you don't love it, it will eat you, you know. But if you love it, it's almost like, you know, if you love something, then nothing can hurt you. You know what I mean?
So right. Absolutely.
I think that is good. I think that's where the guts of it lives. And, you know, I raised a daughter by myself. So I just, and, you know, when I did Vice Squad, it was like, you know, being on the streets and watching these people and just, you know, my God. And what they were willing to do to survive. And, you know, what, you know, if somebody wants to take a picture of you, it's like, oh, God, he loves me, I'm a star. You know, it's amazing what happens. And a lot of the runaways come out here, you know. So, you know, pimps have their ways with them, drugs, the whole thing. There's a, you know, a broken heart on every, there are at least 10 broken hearts for every star on Hollywood Boulevard, you know.
Right.
And
yeah, absolutely.
Buried under the stars. I always wanted to get, there's a place at the end of Hollywood Boulevard, Sunset, Hollywood and Vine, where it's the Man's Chinese Theater, where you can do your footprints and all that stuff. And I wanted to get somebody to do a sculpture of the unknown actor, you know, and put a little park there where people could go just sit and stare, you know, and not be bothered.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, you know, just because... For every one of these stars, it's just, you know, hundreds of us, you know, just, you know, it's just fallen by the cracks and had their dreams shattered, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like how many stories out there that, you know, of that kind of scenario where people don't know about, you know. It's pretty mind-boggling when you think about it.
Well, I would imagine, you know, for every horror, there's a story, you know. And, you know, it's not like you're born a horror, born a drug addict, or born, you know... you know, these things that you wouldn't necessarily want to do, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I think that's where Jack lived. And I think he cared. And, you know, he was in a system that's like, don't care or he'll kill you. you know, like surgeons don't cry kind of thing. That's kind of the LAPD, you know, don't let it get you. Because if you let it get you for 20 years, you know, in the LAPD, you're going to be insane. You know, so you got to be able to shrug it off. But I think the guy, I think he cared. I think that's what the drinking was about, you know. And yeah, but thanks for asking that question. That's a good question.
You all right?
Yeah, I grew up in these streets. Hollywood. It was a lot different back then.
What was it like?
Safe. Clean. Hell, it was even glamorous. I actually saw Roy Rogers and Dale Evans riding their horses right down the street.
Guess I was born 50 years too late.
50 years? No. It wasn't that long ago. Thank you.
One thing too, being a second-time director, are you comfortable behind the camera? Are you do you storyboard stuff? I'm just really interested in terms of, the visual look of the film is really fascinating and really beautiful. So I wanted to see how much preparation you put into it. I mean, do you know going in on the set each day that you know you're going to shoot from this angle? Are you a storyboarder?
No, not a storyboarder, but I do it all in my head. And, I read the scene for the next day and then dream on it, you know. And, I know it might sound a little airy-fairy, but it's true. You read. I do that as an actor, you know, and the next day you kind of wake up and you go, okay, I know what I'm going to do. A lot of it's got to do with confidence, you know. But, we wanted to go with greens and reds, you know, for colors and, you know, the shading. And I think the music had a lot to do with it. I really wanted to get a horn, you know, just the jazz side of L.A. That was exciting.
Yeah, it's a noir soundtrack, essentially. Yeah. It's kind of a dark, you know, Hollywood noir on a certain level. One thing I really think it's brilliant about, too, is the script and how and the progression in terms of how what the villain does. You know, the villain is so interesting in the sense that which was Gary Wirtz, right? I think it Wirtz
right.
is that his name? Yeah. And, how I think it's absolutely brilliant how he decides to come and visit you at your house when you're on suspension.
Yeah, that was wonderful, wasn't it? And he played it beautifully, you know, because he's one of the nicest guys in the world. I mean, he's just like, you know, kind of help you with, you know, right? And he had this wonderful daughter who came to the set, but he went, she doesn't have to be here today. I think he was doing the psycho stabbing thing, but I thought he played that beautifully when he came out, you know, on the balcony in Malibu. That was wonderful. He was just a wonderful actor. But and that was the thing. It was like, the guy was a filmmaker, you know. Here's a guy who came out to be a filmmaker, probably went to film school, you know, was learning how to do it, and he couldn't get anything going, you know, and, you know, he turned bitter. And, you know, people do go crazy here, you know, and they go crazy everywhere, but, I mean, people can go that nuts, you know, to where, okay, I'm gonna, you know, Coppola's nothing, watch this, you know. Scorsese, watch this, you know. Deer Hunter, are you kidding? Watch this. You know, I got live bullets, you know. I'm going to show you what it's really about. You know, people just get caught up in their things, you know. Now, I'm not saying people, you know, go that far, but, you know, I thought it was a great examination and crazy and bitterness that he didn't make it, that nobody gave him a break or whatever, and he was going to, you know. And then the little guy with him, Mitch Hara, who's just, I've had him, I think, almost in every film I've done.
Latin Jerry, yeah.
Latin Jerry, yeah.
Yeah, Mike's a big fan of Latin Jerry.
Ooh, Latin Jerry, yeah.
I came up with that name because there was a Ram, a football player they called Latin Barry, I think. And I went, oh, that's great, man. We'll call him Latin Jerry.
Yeah, you did. He did. You also cast him again in Skins, another directorial effort you did. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I did one other with him. I think so. Yeah. So, yeah, he's a wonderful guy, wonderful actor.
Yeah, he's got a very sleazy aspect to him.
Oh, he's so fun. He's so much fun. He just, you know, he is what he is. I mean, he's just, you know, he's a flame, you know, that's just burning on bright at all times, you know. And, you know, he's gay and proud and just, you know, like I care less, right?
I was just saying, who came up with the movies the choice of movies that you guys decided to, you know, in terms of the killing in the film, because you've got The Deer Hunter, you've got Scarface, Psycho, right. Came up with all those.
I did, yeah. It was good, huh? It was so much fun. And what was great is that you could always cut to those, and you know, they were almost like an anchor point in the film, you know, of reality. I mean, we all knew these films, you know, so it was interesting to keep going back there. I thought the scene in the Psycho scene, I think Gary and I came up with that, actually, because I think we were talking about it, and that's the one where he's one of his daughters show up. I think we were talking about it, and then we just went, the hair, the wig, yeah, you know, and we just started back and forth, and then we, you know, just got a shower and a shower curtain in the middle of that, in the set, and shot it there. And then the love scene, the counter playing back and forth, that was I thought, really interesting.
Right, that's a brilliant juxtaposition, too. It's probably one of my favorite sequences of the movie. The whole sex and orgasm thing is just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Sex and death.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Right, thanks, man, yeah. Yeah,
and
like
then...
that.
What about the other murders? Were those also based on movies as well, or just good ideas?
Which ones?
Like there was the woman who was hanging upside down, and then there was also the woman who was hanging from her neck as well.
Right. Yeah, I don't think so. I think those were just thrown in. You know, they had no significance other than I think he was getting back at. I'm having a hard time recalling. I remember the girl hanging. I'm trying to figure out. I haven't seen the film in a long time. I don't know. I can't remember.
You know, I didn't know if you were going for some, like, Italian giallo thing or something. Because it
no,
looked kind of Argento or something, but I wasn't sure.
No. No, I can't recall that. I can't recall what the thing was. Did she rat somebody out or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I think she might have.
Martha was her name, yes. We hung her. I remember the hanging.
Yeah, she rats him out. Yeah, she rats him out to Jack.
Oh,
absolutely.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Then that's what it is. Yeah.
Nice.
And yeah, and the girl having her picture taken. This was amazing. That was to me, it was about as real as it got. I knew a guy like this. He used to deal drugs, and he was also a photographer. And he would he'd get these girls up there, you know, and they wanted their pictures taken. And you give him a little blow, you know, and the next thing you know, their tops are coming off. And I mean, he was a master at that, and that's what that was about. And that was the degradation of a woman, I felt, that, you know, goes on in this town. It's like, you know, they come out here with a dream, and if you kind of, you know, seduce them into thinking you can produce that dream, you know, and take a few pictures here, just drop that off your shoulder kind of thing, you know. And the next thing, you know, they're topless. Bottomless, you know, in some magazine, and their father's looking at it in Ohio. You know, they're going, oh, yeah, I was dumb. You're dumb then. It's like, you know, how many stars have you heard saying that, you know? Well, I was really young when I did that, you know. And that's because they fell prey to that same seductive thing here.
So I know this is a little off subject, but I'd kind of be remiss because I'm a real big fan in the sense that I know you worked with Richard Pryor on JoJo, and
oh,
I was wondering what that experience was like for you.
Oh, it was just the best. Richard Pryor to me was just like, you know, the day I went in to meet with him, I had, there's a wonderful casting director out here. His name is Ruben Cannon, and he's about really the only African-American casting director. There might be a couple others, but I mean, he's been the guy throughout. He cast me in Soldier Story, JoJo's Answer. Anyhow, he calls me in to meet Richard Pryor, which, you know, is enough to lock your knees up. I mean, what are you doing today? Oh, I've got to go, you know, deal with Richard Pryor. God, you know. So I go in, I walk in the door, and he immediately, you know, starts off on Ramrod and Vice Squad. So he kind of puts me at ease. I feel like, oh, okay, the guy's seen my work. This is cool. But now what I'm going to do, I have to make him laugh. So what I do is, you know, we're talking, spritzing back and forth, and then it's like time to do the reading, right? So I turn around, turn my back to him, and I turn really fast, and I have the biggest grin on my face, and I just start laughing as loud and as hard as I can, looking right into his eyes, and I don't stop until that son of a bitch started laughing. And he started laughing, and I laughed more. Ruben Cannon started laughing. We were all all just laughing at absolutely nothing. And I knew right there, this part's mine. You know, because I'm making Richard Pryor laugh, for God's sakes, you know. How many people can say that? Dramatic actors. So anyhow, we finish out the scene. I get the role, you know, and then working with him, I was just, you know, you want me to go on? Do you feel good about this?
Absolutely.
Okay, so it's the first day we're shooting. We're shooting in this club, the same nightclub that he entertained in back in the 60s when he arrived. It's called the Stardust, I think, or the Starwood. The Starwood on Sunset, you know, Santa Monica and Crescent Heights. Okay, so, and he's like, you know, he's having kind of a rough day and everything. He actually came to my dressing room, right? Now, I'm just, you know, I'm you know, this is Richard Pryor. And he comes to me and he says, Wings, do you think I should do my act, you know, today, you know, with a few people here and just, like, cover myself or, like, wait another day? And I'm, like, going, you're going to do your act from the 60s? No, do it today. Do it right now, you know, just being the greedy bastard I am. And so, like, we walk in there. There may be, I don't know, with the crew, there might be, like, six or seven others, you know, who just sit down at the table, and Richard does his act verbatim from, you know, from the 60s. And it's just, it's so incredible. It was just brilliant. And from that moment on, we just became dear, dear friends. We, you know, and then he got the MS, and, you know, we would play poker. I would say he would show up at our poker game maybe once a month with the MS, you know, and in the wheelchair and just, you know, on a last leg, it seemed like. But, you know, as alive mentally as he ever was, funny as hell over his condition. I mean, you ask him how he's doing, he'd just go, I'm fucked. You know? And the reading alone made you laugh, you know. You just go, God, well, of course you are. You know, it's just, what a stupid question. You know, here's a guy who should have set himself on fire, you know. He's got MS. Yeah, you're fucked. Okay, good. Let's play poker. And I got to tell you, this poker game was just unbelievable. Sid Caesar was to my left and Milton Berle was to my right. Richard Pryor was across from me. Charles Bronson was to the left. And then there were several, you know, come and goers, you know, like Robert Wall and, you know, people like that. This was just an incredible poker game. It was every Tuesday night at a guy named Norby Walters' house, who's an old-time music guy who just put together, and this is a cheap poker game, $40 buy-in, and you're playing with millionaires, man. You know, these guys are worth millions, and it's a $40 buy-in, and, you know, the most the guy's going to win is $100 walking out of there. Mel Torme, guys like that, you know, and what it was just basically a bunch of guys getting together, and somehow I fell into this thing, you know. It was just amazing. Can you imagine having that kind of talent around you and not spending that much money? That was great.
Why hasn't anyone painted that picture yet? You know, like the dogs playing poker?
Yeah.
Why
old is it dogs playing poker?
Really? I'm not kidding you. Jerry Vale, Mel Torme. The list went on.
I'm waiting for Elvis to show up.
Oh, yeah.
Elvis walks in.
Andrew Dickinson, you know. I think she actually showed up. I wasn't there. I was out of town, I think. But I think she actually showed up. But it was amazing, and, you know. But Richard was he was actually the kindest director I've ever worked with, I think. Just as kind as can be. God, I miss him. Sweet soul. And the funniest guy, you know.
So, you know, working with him, you know, as a director, do you learn anything from him going on to doing your own directorial films?
I think kindness. I think being kind, you know. You don't have to yell, you don't have to scream, you know. One of the first things I did on my first directing job, it was a film called Cold Fire. If you ever get it, there's an ambulance scene where the ambulance is there.
I have it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, if you go back and look at it, there's an ambulance at night, and there's a dead girl on the gurney, and there's an old woman who is crying, who is like her mother or whatever. She was an extra. I walked up to her and I asked her, would you mind doing this little scene here, right? She was an extra. And she goes, oh, no, okay. And so when it came time for her to cry, here's what I did. I honestly did this. I took her in my arms and hugged her. and I whispered this in her ear. And people thought, you know, I was just this great director, like I was whispering something incredible. And I was like going, you know what? If you cry, everybody's going to think I'm an incredible director. Okay, do you think you could cry? And she goes, oh, sure, I could do that for you. And I went, okay, well, why don't you just start crying now? And then when you're there, I'll just let you go and we'll just start rolling the camera. And she goes, okay. And she's crying, man. And it's like, you know, people are like going, how'd you do that, man? That's brilliant. Well, you're brilliant. It was like basically I begged her to do it. You know, so I'm not kidding you. Begging is one of the prerequisites for directing. But I think from Richard, I really learned that, you know. There's a kindness, and there was the thing, you know, he was loud, and, you know, his reputation was like, you know, all funny and everything. But he was a shy man and just a tender heart, you know. I mean, a guy, you know, grew up in a whorehouse, what can I tell you?
So we have time for just one more question, and I wanted to see, you know, because I'm a huge admirer of Art of Dying, and I've told you before, and right. I wanted to see with such a, you know, with a huge body of work that you have, and you know, the directing you've done and all the acting you've done, mm-hmm. how does Art of Dying stand for you in terms of the pantheon of your career? I mean,
it's one of my favorite films. You know, I gotta tell you, there's nothing better than having an actor, you know, say your dialogue. You know, so I think I I've directed some real dogs. You know, the first one was like, you know, and this was Skins. I don't think, you know, the writer sucked. Oh, I wrote that. Anyhow, it just, you know, it didn't click. I didn't think the film clicked. But this one just clicked. It was not only fun, it was just like creative as hell, you know. And it just got all the juices going. So, you know, and you know, it's sloppy in places. You know, and there are things like, you know, we didn't have the money to open up the film and let it breathe more. But I think for what it was, for the money, it's one of my favorites.
Well, except that sex scene is sloppy.
yeah, well, that's supposed to be sloppy.
I think I'll leave you two alone.
Can I get a drink?
Yeah.
Do you mind?
What do you want?
You have impeccable taste in women. She's very lovely.
Look, pal, I'm not at liberty to talk about this case, and besides, I've been suspended, all right?
Well, we don't have to talk about the case, Jack. I interview people with dangerous occupations. People who often come face to face with death. For instance, stalking a killer. You know, there's really not that much difference between you and the killer.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, you stalk the killer stalks someone else. You catch the killer, you get a promotion. He catches his prey and they're dead. What does it feel like to kill someone, Jack? I understand you send more people to the graveyard than you do to jail.
All right, look, your time's up. I'd like you to leave now, all right?
Did you throw Latin Jerry in front of that car, detective?
And when will we see a new film from you?
So, and here's what we're doing. On this film that Callie, my partner, and I are doing, we're going to do two more days, not reshoots, but added scenes. And then we're going to go back in the editing room. And she'll continue to edit it. I'm not editing it. I'm working on the music. And so I figure this film, although we can't release the title yet, because we're still trying to figure it out if it's legal, but it should be out by 2058. It's our company's first film. Every frame will be perfect. You understand?
It's gonna be
you will not be
now.
Able to criticize anything. My mother, actually, when she was living, she sent me this great cartoon. And it was about this director who had edited his own film. And the entire film was on the floor. And he had edited everything. There was no film left. And the caption was, I'm done. That's us.
Nice.
But we're doing really good. This little company that we started, I'm just so excited by it because we can control our own thing. You know, it's like the little gig we had with PM. You know, but they had the final say. Now we're going to have the final say on our stuff. You know, and Callie's You know, she's got a hell of a little fan base going, you know, and I got my fan base. And if they all pitch in, you know, this would be just great. We might get enough to make our next film.
Right, and you know that we will do anything we can do to help you push that along the way as well, too.
Oh, I'd exactly. Love it. Yeah, I think September, October, we'll be ready to show, you know, the first screening. You guys will be right there.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
Okay, and we're back.
So, Michael, this was your first time getting to talk to Wings. What did you think?
That was amazing. I love interviews like that. I love interviews where we basically just say, go. And they talk, and they go where they need to go. And some of those stories are just fucking hilarious. I had to keep muting. You know, I sat here muted my microphone and just completely just losing it. I mean, the whole Bob Denver thing just had me going so much. That was awesome.
Yeah, he's got a ton of stories like that. I've talked to him several times. He's called me up and we've talked, became friends, and he's told me all kinds of crazy stories that you wouldn't believe, but, you know, of course I can't print them or talk about them, but I can share them with you, you know, off mic or whatever. But yeah, it's such a crazy story. Like, you know, his dad was a writer in Hollywood in the 30s, and he wrote for all these like radio shows like Inner Sanctum, and he was almost blacklisted for the McCarthy thing. And so, you know, Wings is a really interesting guy, and you know, he's had a great career. He's been working nonstop since the late 70s. You know, he often plays, you know, these tough guy cop roles with heart. But, you know, there's a lot more to him. I think he brings a certain intensity to his performances. And, you know, anyone that's seen Vice Squad knows just how crazy he can be. So, you know, he's one of my favorite actors. I really like him a lot.
Yeah, and it's nice to see that he's still working. You know, I just watched Rubber recently, and it was really nice to see him in that.
You know, they made Rubber with one of those new cameras that's basically like a still camera that's able to capture, you know, the moving image as well. And the one thing that kind of pisses me off about Rubber, though, is the fact is you see all these interviews right now all over the web, all over, you know, film festivals with the director, Quentin. You never see any fucking interviews with Wings Hauser. And, you know, the French, like, you know, they love Jerry Lewis, and they also really like Wings Hauser. So, you know, I was kind of shocked that with all the PR and stuff that the film had, he didn't get any coverage. And frankly, what annoys me is the fact that the tire was billed over Wings in the movie.
That is pretty sucky. Yeah, Wings, after all the movies that he's done, he should have had top billing over the tire. So I know that you're a huge Wings Hauser fan. And for folks out there that haven't seen a whole lot of Wings, what do you recommend to them as far as a good starting point and where they should go from there?
Well, the perfect starting point is Vice Squad, because that is considered one of his greatest performances. And then, you know, he's done so many good films. Like, he's been involved with some not-so-good films. But the thing about those is, while they may be, you know, not the best work, there's not a bad Wings Hauser performance. It makes sense. So it's a great performance in a lackluster movie at times.
So he's like the Gene Hackman of lower budget movies.
Right. You know, like he did, which is just god awful. He did Beastmaster 2, Portal Through Time, which is just horrible. But Wings Hauser's pretty good at it, actually, for, you know, the kind of character he's playing. So standout performances would obviously be The Art of Dying, Vice Squad, and then he did, which is one of my favorite movies, Norman Mailer's Tough Guys Don't Dance, which he's just brilliant in. So yeah, he's a director. You know, he did The Art of Dying, obviously, what we're talking about. Plus, he also did this movie called Skins, which is kind of hard to find. I have a copy of it with his son, Cole Hauser. You know, if people that aren't familiar made the connection, the Kohlhauser is the redheaded guy from Dazed and Confused. He played Benny in that movie. He was in Good Will Hunting. He's on television now. That's Wings' son. And also, Wings did this amazing movie as an actor, which is kind of a little scene called Street Asylum. And this is a crazy movie from the late 80s. That's directed by Gregory Dark, who was, you know, he was an adult film director. And it's got Wings Hauser and Brian James in it. And it's just this whole, it's this cop movie, this supernatural cop movie. It's got G. Gordon Liddy in it.
Nice.
it's awesome. And like, it's this movie you watch and like, everyone seems like they're on crack in the movie. Like all the performances are so edgy and over the top. You've got to wonder if everyone on that fucking set wasn't snorting huge lines of cocaine. Because their eyes are all bulging out of their head. It's just, it's wacky. But, yeah, so, you know, that movie and then Tough Guys Don't Dance. There's a great movie he directed called No Safe Haven. He's just done a ton of work that's really great. And, you know, you could sit there and collect movies all day. And, you know, you couldn't probably find all the Wings Hauser movies. You know, also, I want to point out, too, is he actually was the writer. He was the one that came up with the story and he wrote the script for the Gene Hackman movie Uncommon Valor.
Ah, very cool, very cool. And then from what I understand, Wings Hauser and Kohlhauser are not at all related to Rutger Hauer, which I found out yesterday through the internets, and I was just absolutely flabbergasted about.
But that's the beautiful thing about the internet is it teaches.
Exactly. It is a learning tool. So you can learn all kinds of valuable information through the internets.
Internets, plural. Hey, man. So yeah, you know, there's a really interesting scene in Art of Dying, which is the scene, because actually, you know, let me backtrack a little bit. And, you know, one of the things that happens in the film is he's this cop with heart. And, you know, the whole thing is this statement on Hollywood. The film is this statement on Hollywood where, you know, all these young actresses fresh off the bus get involved with adult films. And so Wings Hauser's character, Jack, is, you know, kind of this ne'er-do-well police officer who's always rescuing these actresses off the bus from doing adult films. And, you know, he rescues one from Latin Jerry.
Christmas, Hollywood, present.
And, you know, so the whole thing's a statement on how Hollywood can eat someone up and spit them out, you know. So, but there's this great scene where one of the actresses, Wings Hauser takes her to the bus stop and, you know, she decides at the last minute she's not going to go home. And so she ends up on the coast out at this little diner that's run by this guy named Wally. And I can't, the name of the guy who plays Wally is escaping me right now, but he's this brilliant character actor and you've seen him in a bunch of stuff. And anyways, there's a jukebox in the diner. And as they're talking, you hear this great music in the background that, you know, and you hear it at first, it almost sounds like you're going to hear you're hearing some intro to an Elton John song or something. And you hear this great voice and that is actually Wings Hauser. Because he's also a brilliant musician, and he put out this great album in the 70s called Your Love Keeps Me Off the Streets. And it's a great album. I worked with Wings, and we put it up on YouTube so people could hear it because it's never been on CD, and it's impossible to find on vinyl even. I was lucky to find it last year in unopened vinyl, like a cutout.
Nice.
I paid out my ass for it, but it's amazing. So you can hear the whole thing on YouTube, and it's you know, he's a great songwriter too. So it's really great that you get to hear that music in the film.
Just backtracking a little bit, the name of the guy that played Wally was Sidney Lassick.
Yeah.
And he was amazing as Cheswick in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but he was even better in Cool as Ice. I loved when he popped up in Cool as Ice. I was like, yes, it's Cheswick.
When are we going to cover Cool as Ice? I'm patiently waiting, Nurse Ratched.
Oh man, we totally have to cover that movie. I really wanted to talk to Robert Van Winkle and see, you know, what it was like making that movie. Is Michael Gross still around? Because I wonder. I bet you he would give us an in. Is he dead or is he alive?
No, Michael Gross. He's very...
okay. Good.
What's that say about Michael Gross?
I know. Well, I've been waiting for Tremors 5, and without that, I don't know the status of his life or his career. But unfortunately, Sidney Lassick passed away a few years ago, so we will not be able to talk to him about that. Yeah.
Well, I'm waiting for the Michael Gross Family Ties reunion. I'm waiting for that to happen.
That would be awesome.
Is it politically incorrect to make fun of Michael J. Fox?
You can make fun of Michael Jackson. You cannot make fun of Michael J. Fox.
Okay. I was just wondering, because since I got back from Manila, my mind's just been really out of whack.
So, you know, Justin, we credited Wingshauser as a writer and director at the beginning of this episode. Actually, I credit him as that. And then what kind of movies has he written? Because it looks like, at least according to those internets that we were talking about, those all informative informational internets, looks like a guy named Joseph Merti wrote this film.
Well, the internets can be inaccurate sometimes.
What? What? How dare you say that?
No. Never. Yeah, he, you know, he actually, Wings gave him credit. I think they worked on it, collaborated on the screenplay, but Wings did actually write the film. I think it was a situation where he didn't want to take the credit in terms of, I'm the star, I'm the director, and I'm also the writer of a movie. So, I don't know, I can see his point, because it almost comes across as legally egotistical on a certain extent, but yeah, he did write the film.
So, who is this Joseph Merti guy? I mean, that's not just a pseudonym or something. He was an actual person, right?
I think you'd have to check the internets for that.
Okay, yeah, well, it looks like he's done a couple things, so it seems like he's probably a real person and not just a Alan Smithy-type pseudonym that are used by people. So he's written, directed, and produced just a shitload of stuff.
Wait, Alan Smithy's not real?
I know, you would think.
He's been the director of some of my favorite films.
Especially Burn, Hollywood Burn. That one was probably one of the best films ever made.
And Dune.
Oh, yeah. Well, I like his version of Dune, especially that opening part. You know, that's just riveting.
Yeah, I love Alan Smithy. He's genius. So, you know, earlier on in the episode, I mentioned that I thought Art of Dying reminded me somewhat of Peeping Tom. So I wanted to see what your thoughts were on that statement.
I can totally see that. You know, Peeping Tom is definitely one of my favorite films. And I don't know, I've kind of got a long history of it. I had to see that film quite a few times when I was in school. And read all the Laura Mulvey commentary on that, which is hilarious to read. I don't know if you've ever read any of her commentary on Peeping Tom, but it's very funny to read film criticism from back in that era, because it was before the age of video. So a lot of times the people that were writing film criticism would sit in the theater and write down their notes. And when they came back to actually write down what they were, their theories on some of these films were, their memories weren't necessarily so good. So there are a lot of things in some of these older film articles where it's like, you know, they'll write what they want to have happened rather than what actually happened. So it's pretty funny to look at the two side by side, but I can definitely see a comparison between the two things. And it almost would have been cool if there had been more of a direct correlation between Peeping Tom and Art of Dying, and having the director character with the knife tripod. That would have been pretty awesome. So I like where he was going with the nods to the older films. I kind of wish he would have went a little bit farther with it. And it sounds sick to say, but I wish there would have been more murders in Art of Dying.
Yeah, you know, who knows how many he actually committed, really. You know, I think the correlation to Peeping Tom is, for me, is in the sense that both of them are, you know, they receive somewhat of an erotic stimulation from filming the deaths, I think, on a certain level. And, you know, I think even Latin Jerry, who is, you know, you should have been cast in that role, I think. So,
fabulous!
Right. I think you should have been cast as Latin Jerry. And, you know, I think even he is aroused by the fact, too, because, you know, there's that great scene where they're sitting together watching some of the footage that they've shot. And it's kind of like it reminds me of, you know, the sex scene in Rocky Horror where you know, Magenta and Riff Raff slowly clasp hands, and that's the way that, you know, they get it on. There's
the elbow sex.
Right, yeah, right. So there's that great scene with Latin Jerry and the killer, who's played by Gary Wirtz. I think his name is pronounced Wirtz. Anyways, yeah, you know, where Latin Jerry slowly takes his hand. And that's when you first see, like, they establish their relationship, whether he's, you know, Latin Jerry's not just his henchman, he's like his gay lover.
Yeah, and I like that it wasn't just women being killed in the film either, that it starts with the Deer Hunter homage is great. I've been rereading about John Woo's Bullet in the Head, and, you know, there's so much Deer Hunter influence in that movie. So then to pop in Art of Dying and see that, I was like, oh, hey, this is pretty coincidental, but it was pretty great.
You know, I have a great Laserdisc of Bullet in the Head.
Really? That's terrific.
Also in the film, you know, Wings is love interest, there's a great little twist to the film, you know, in the sense that his love interest is played by Kathleen Kinmont. And if you're not familiar with her, you know, she's had this crazy career in terms of, she sometimes she has bit parts. Like she was one of the corpses in Bride of Reanimator, and then she's also in the older Blade Warrior movies. And but anyway, she's really great. She's this mysterious drifter woman that comes in and out of Wings' character's life, and she's really into, like, you know, kind of kinky sex, and she's to the point, and it's like she's getting it on. And you know, there's this amazing scene where you know, they're really into role playing, and you know, Wings Hauser comes home from a tough night, and he walks in his house, which is on the beach, and she pulls this gun on him, and they go through this whole role playing thing, and eventually just turns into this hot love making action. And there's this great scene where you know, and Wings talked about it in the interview, but you know, there's a scene with him and Kathleen Kimmout where they're getting it on, and they're, you know, sitting on a kitchen countertop, and you know, he's using milk, he's pouring milk all over her, and he's, you know, putting fudge, and there's, you see vegetables on the floor. It's like, what kind of party is this? You know, like, why am I not having these experiences?
Yeah, that was great. And, you know, the thing about this movie is that there's just, it's not a clean movie. You know, it kind of reminds me of our discussion of Deadbeat at Dawn a few weeks ago, where there's such a vibe to it. And I think you said this earlier, but there's definitely that to this movie as well. It's like, it really captures, well, it captures a few things. It captures that, like, you know, 1980s kind of direct-to-video kind of stuff. And it also captures just that real scuzzy L.A. of the time. And he does capture that whole, it's dangerous for young actresses out there, and it's dangerous on the streets of L.A., basically. And it's really, he does a great job of bringing that across without really banging you over the head with it too much. And I like that it's kind of a police procedural, but then the policeman's kind of fucked up. And yeah, that whole scene that you're talking about is definitely like, wow, you know, like, it's pretty obvious to mix sex with death and all that, the whole, you know, the little death mix with real death, but he pulls it off in that one in spades.
It's really well done, you know, and the cinematography, I actually think, is, in the film, is really brilliant too. There's these great, you know, it's a gritty looking film. It's not a noir in any sense, but it has a 50s type of, I mean, it's 80s film, and you're right, it does capture the essence of the 80s, but also it could very well, you could turn it to black and white, and it could do good as a 50s crime movie, you know, like a 50s detective movie. You know, the cinematography is really great in the film. There's a lot of, you know, interesting colors going on. There's this great contrast where he's, you know, switching to this gritty black and white footage, you know, because the killer is filming in black and white 16mm. And, you know, there's this amazing sequence where, like you said, the sex and the death, which is, you know, Wings Hauser getting it on with Kathleen Kinmont in the bathtub with all these candles, and, you know, she's making him go down on her. And, you know, Wings, as the editor supervising the editing, you know, he's doing this sequence of Kathleen Kinmont having an orgasm in the bathtub, and he's cutting to this poor girl naked in the shower, getting slaughtered with a knife, screaming her head off to, you know, some killer's recreation of the shower scene from Psycho. And there's this great, really fast cutting sequence of orgasm versus death. You know, it's a real great concept, and it's beautifully done. And, you know, there's also some really great twists in the story too, in the sense that it's not a typical cop chasing a serial killer movie, in the sense that, you know, after Wings captures Latin Jerry, you know, what more is there to do but hunt a serial killer? And instead of just following that traditional pattern, you know, the twist is the serial killer comes to Wings, you know, posing as a reporter. And that's what I think the great twist in the story happens.
Oh, way to give it away, dude. Come on. No, and the best thing about Kathryn Kinmont, well, first off, she is super hot in the film, but she is one of these ladies who just gets better looking as she ages. She is just still smoking hot.
I almost want to feel like she was married to Lorenzo Lamas at one point, and she was in, like,
She was in Renegade. Yeah,
that's what I thought, right. Yeah, she's in, there's another great twist to her story in the film, too, is, you know, you think she's this drifter, and then all the time, at the end, you find out she's actually a cop.
Oh, way to spoil it again, man. Jeez.
I know, I've ruined it, but it's amazing. It's well worth checking out. It's really hard to find, actually. You can find it on VHS, I think, but the DVD is, like, really out of print, and it's, I want to say it's, like, you know, $40-$50 to get the DVD.
Yeah, it's absolutely outrageous over on Amazon, and yeah, it's a tough one to find. I wish they would bring that one out again. The thing that really got me, speaking of twist to the story, was when we come to the end and we find out that the whole time the filmmaker was just looking for the sled that he had when he was a little boy. And that was just like, oh, so that's what Rosebud is. It's like, oh, you know.
And it's all a dream anyways, on top of that.
Yeah,
a mystery wrapped inside of a riddle, wrapped inside of an enigma.
Wrapped inside of an eggshell. When he wakes up and he's next to Suzanne Pleshette, it was like, oh, okay, this whole time.
Yep. I think that I'll throw people now. One thing I'd like to talk about, too, is, you know, there's, you know, in the home video market in the 80s and the 90s, you know, you had this company called PM Entertainment, who was notorious for releasing direct-to-video, low-budget films. You know, they did, which I want to actually cover someday. The reason I'm not pushing it on you is because, you know, the star of the film is dead. But I'd really like to cover Anna Nicole Smith's Skyscraper because it's so good. Like, and Nicole's...
And the outtakes for that are amazing. Just playing the audio from the outtakes is terrific.
Are you joking? Are you serious?
No, I'm saying, like, have you seen that, the outtakes? Oh, my God. It's this whole thing where she's trying, like, there's probably, like, a 20-minute little film where it's the editor took all the outtakes and put them onto one reel. And she's there, like, I want to land in your hair space.
And I love it. That's my favorite part, right? Because at the beginning, you know, her helicopter or the boyfriend, you know, she's on the, like, her headset to him. She's like, I want to have a baby.
Oh, God,
she
says
helicopter. It's so awesome. I love that movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I will gladly do that with you whenever, dude. That one is, I can't wait to see the rest of the movie. If the outtakes are that good, I can't wait to see the rest of the film.
Oh, yeah. She made two films for, I think there's actually, I got to buy that because I have one of them on Laserdisc. And plus I have an episode of Monster Vision where they did To the Limit, which is her and I think Joey Travolta.
Nice.
That one's great. And, you know, Joey Travolta's nailing her, and she's naked. And even Joe Bob was making all these great comments. But anyways, yeah, so I think there's a twofer DVD called A Skyscraper and To the Limit on the same set.
Oh, awesome.
But yeah, those are, I'd like to cover those. But yeah, PM Entertainment put those out. And, you know, they did like a Bikini Summer and, you know, all these, you know, nefarious B-movies that came out in home video or you would see them on late night Cinemax. They put these all out in the 80s and the 90s. So I think they did like Fred Olen Ray movies too. I'm not sure. But anyways, I have to wonder, being The Art of Dying being so good, I wonder what the response would have been, or maybe it would have been bigger had it seen a theatrical release or got distributed by a studio or, you know, some big conglomerate distribution company instead of someone like PM Entertainment, which nothing bad. I'm not ragging on PM Entertainment because I actually like their movies. I've seen almost all of them and I own most of them and I really like some of those really bad B movies. But I have to wonder if The Art of Dying, you know, could have been something bigger had it been released with another company.
Yeah, I can totally see that. I mean, this one, you hit this one out of the park this week. I mean, Art of Dying was right up there with Stripteaser for me. It was just I hate to use like the typical film critic kind of one quote kind of, this was a cinematic thrill ride from start to finish. But this one was really great. And it was one of those where I never would have picked it up on my own, but I really appreciate you showing it to me. And I hope that, you know, though it is out of print out there, I hope that our listeners can find a copy of this because it is really worth the time.
Right.
We need a self-sufficient law enforcement robot.
How long will it take?
We can go to prototype within 90 days.
Where are you from?
Metro South.
Welcome to hell.
All units, Sector 9.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me.
Really good.
Half machine.
RoboCop. What is he?
He's a cyborg, you idiot.
All hero.
What are your prime directives?
Protect the innocent.
Let the woman go,
or there will be
trouble.
Uphold the law.
You are under arrest.
What is this shit?
Justice gets an upgrade.
Looking for me?
Your move, creep.
RoboCop.
Thank you for your cooperation. Good night.
The That was audio from the trailer for next week's pick, mine, the 1987 film RoboCop. Next week, we'll be covering the film as well as speaking to a whole plethora of people, including Nancy Allen, Miguel Ferrer, Ronnie Cox, Ed Neumeier, Michael Miner, Ed Naha, Monty Hellman. It's just going to be chock full of good stuff.
Hi, I'm Shadow Stevens, and you're in the projection booth with Mike and Justin. No, seriously.
So, final thoughts on Art of Dying or Wings Hauser?
I am so glad that you brought this movie to my attention. I'm glad that we watched it, and I'm glad that we had the chance to talk to Wings Hauser, because that was a hoot, and I am looking forward to seeing some more of his films. So I appreciate you kind of putting me down that path with this guy who I never really would have, you know, I've seen him 1,000 times. I mean, he shows up in television all over the place and in movies, and I've never been that well aware of his career. So now I've got somebody else that I need to watch out for.
So I guess that's about it. You know, FYI, for anyone that's been paying attention, Mike is no longer a fan of jujubes and has now switched over to enjoying snow caps, as we're here each week from the projection booth.
My favorite non-perials.
So that's it for another fun-filled Golden Cob, Don't Wake the Kids episode of the projection booth. Special thanks goes out to my friend Wings Hauser for doing more stuff with me. I know he's listening. We're going to go out with another rarity, a track from Wings' album, Your Love Keeps Me Off the Streets. The album is not on CD, but you can find it on YouTube. You can't find it for download or on iTunes or anything like that. It's a great album and has a great backstory to how it came about, but I can't share that one on air. But Mike, I will tell you about it after we shut off our microphones.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Right. So at the time Wings was writing this album, he was working as a night security guard at a church, and you're never going to guess how he...
The night, don't be shy. There's nothing more we can hide. Pull the covers, let's discover what's going on inside. Baby, the sky might fall, and so just let me know you. We'll be right back.
Christmas, Hollywood, present.